We've covered a lot of new stuff and a lot of new concepts and ideas. And before we jump now to the theory of the state itself, we'll first look at a Christian social theory as the background, and then specifically the institution of the state. I thought it would be a good idea to summarize everything, to cover briefly point two and remind you of all the different things that we've covered so far. We started with what we all find in our own experience, that the things and the events that surround us exhibit properties of different kinds, and those properties are ordered. They're not chaotic. There's an order to them that reflects their law, the laws that govern them. So they are kinds of properties and laws. So there are quantitative, spatial, physical, sensory properties related to one another by laws. There are necessary truths in every one of those aspects. One plus one must make two. If two triangles are equal, angle, side, angle, then they're congruent. Being blue excludes being red. All that kind of thing. They're orderly. We classify things, the things that we experience, according to the aspects in which they possess their properties actively. So a rock is only passive, sensorily or logically, but it's active as so far as its physical characteristics are concerned. If you remember, we had that little chart comparing a rock and a plant and an animal and finally a human being. we call that its qualifying function. The qualifying aspect of the thing is also the one whose laws determine the overall organization, the internal organization of the thing taken as a whole. So whether that's a rock, and we have some kind of crystalline structure, whether it's a plant, which is qualified biotically, or it's an artifact, we're going to look for the qualifying aspect of the thing, and in order to get a focus on its nature. Artifacts differ from natural things, and the two aspects qualify their nature. One aspect, Dewey calls it the foundational function of the thing. That's the aspect whose laws govern the process of forming it. And then there is the aspect that's its leading function. That was the aspect that provided the kinds of thing it was intended to become. It's what the thing now is. Whereas before it was only natural material, now it has become something new. And the nature of that varies depending on the artifact. Some artifacts are works of art, so they're qualified aesthetically. That would be their leading function. Some artifacts are tools. They are qualified formatively. They are formed in order to help form other things. And we covered that sort of thing, but I'm reminding you of where we've come. Then I pointed out that social communities are also artifacts. People form them. People join them, leave them. They're not natural in the sense of being a natural material that we find in the world. And there are all kinds of social communities. Marriage, family, church, school, business, labor union, charitable organizations for the preservation of health, hospitals, clinics. There are all sorts in society. And the question arises then, how are they related to one another? And the collectivist answer was that there's some overarching community that includes all the others, and all the others are parts of it, and all the members, all the human beings that are members, are parts of that great overarching organization. And in the history of human thought, that's almost always been argued to be the state. The political institution of society, which has its goal, making and enforcing laws. The government is the ruling body, and the claim has been made over and over that that's the supreme institution in society, includes all the others. So we took up the question about individualism and collectivism. Collectivism argues that the state is the whole, and that's more important. It's prior to the parts because it produces the parts. The parts can't function correctly without it. We then distinguish between a part-whole relation and another kind of relationship, which is often goes unnoticed, and that is that there are wholes that are comprised of lesser wholes, smaller wholes, combining to make a greater whole. Dory Word's term for that is encapsis, and I called it a capsulate relation. And what we wanted to argue was that for something to really be a part of another thing, it's not only the case that it can't come into existence apart from the other and plays an internal role in the organization of the other, but that it has to have the same qualifying function. That's why a cell really is part of a plant. They're both biotically qualified. It's why, let's say, the moon, our moon, can be part of the solar system. Same qualification. Now, what we then wanted to argue on Christian grounds was that humans are not merely parts of anything. They have no qualification. There is no qualifying function for a human being. Human beings are the only things we know of that function in all of the aspects, actively and passively. But at their core, humans are religious beings created for fellowship with God. And that has to do with the human heart in biblical language, the center of human existence. It's the seat of our identity and the source of what makes us what we are. There's a text that says, from the heart come the issues of life. And we were reminded in the New Testament that it's with the heart that one believes. If you believe in your heart and confess with your lips that Jesus is Christ, then you have the salvation that he came to bring you. That puts humans, in one sense, above nature. That is, there's something about the human heart that is not determined by the laws of these aspects or other causal laws or any others that exist. There's a center there that's genuinely free. Free to choose to do good or evil. Free to choose your course in life and so on. That freedom is real. And it's because of that, humans have no qualifying function, and therefore they're never just parts of any community. Their relation to communities is that there are sub-wholes that function in those communities in specific ways, depending on the nature of the community. What we're trying to get at, then, are the natures of communities. What's the relation of them that they have to one another? Is it really true, as the collectivist says, that all other institutions in society, marriage, family, business, place of or religious worship, and so on, are they all parts of the state? And given the definitions that we have that include that for something to be a part of another thing, it has to be the case that it can't come into existence without that other, without the larger whole. It can't function without it, and it has to have the same qualifying function. And that being the case, the startling outcome here is that no major kind of social community is a part of any other. They have distinct qualifying functions. Marriage is qualified by love, as is family. Church is qualified by faith. Business is qualified economically. It's there to provide a product or service so that people can make a living. A health organization is there to preserve people's biological well-being. Then there are organizations that try to preserve their psychological well-being. And we have all sorts of other institutions, labor unions, sports clubs. There are many, many kinds of institutions in society, communities. And if they have a different qualifying function, they cannot be a part of one another. So we see, we meaning those of us who hold this kind of view, this Christian philosophy, that there is a plurality of kinds of communities, social communities in human society, and that none of them have the same qualifying function. The major ones, marriage, state, church, have different qualifications. And therefore, no one of them can be a part of any other. So we reject the collectivist view, that the state includes all the other institutions, as well as the individuals who are members of them. They are members of the state. The state is the grand overarching whole that makes society and human life possible and is supreme. That's rejected. But it doesn't have to be rejected by being an individualist and claiming that individuals are perfectly capable of existing in solitude without the help of other individuals. Each one can manage just fine, and they don't need a state, but if they think they do, they can form one anytime they want. So all social institutions are voluntary organizations according to the individualist view. Now let's see what we should say about all that. Again, I'm raising this from a Christian point of view. And I mentioned last time that what we want to do is take some of the hints that Scripture gives us in concerning this matter. This is what I mean. The New Testament specifically tells us to pay honor to those who are the officials in the state, and that the state exists to punish evildoers. I think that's not its only function, but it's certainly that is one of them. It exists to enforce the law, to keep the peace. So it specifically mentions the state, and it doesn't say, oh, it's wrong to have states, or we can't wait till the state gets done away because in heaven there will be no state. That's not the way the New Testament talks. Instead, it says the state will be ruled by Jesus Christ as king, and he will bring forth justice. So the state's part of human life. It's an expression of our concern for justice that's natural to us. There are other institutions as well, and I mentioned that they all have different qualifying functions. So let's think about some more hints. What else does the New Testament have to say that we might use as a springboard? Well, it certainly speaks of families. And it specifically tells us that the parents are the authority in the family. One of the commandments is honor your father and your mother. And every commentator who has ever commented on that says, well, of course, it doesn't just mean your father and your mother. This is the first example of authority any of us encounter. It's all legitimate authority that must be respected. So we have a stamp of approval on marriage, family, and state. But the Scripture also speaks of the owners that have a business, that the owner has the right to decide what is going to be produced, what service, how it's going to be run, who's going to be hired, how much they're going to be paid, and so on. So we have an acknowledgement of an economic side of life, business in particular. Abraham Kuyper, the great thinker, Dutch thinker, who became prime minister of the Netherlands back about the time Teddy Roosevelt was president of the United States, was an acute social thinker. And he took these hints and he built a theory of human society around them. And that theory was adopted by Dewey also and expanded. And when we return, we're going to first look at the theory of society as a whole that Kuyper worked out. And it's a theory he called sphere sovereignty. Scripture speaks to us of authorities in life, he says. But there is not one great authority. There are many. The parents in a home, the teacher in a classroom, the owner in a business, the clergy in a church, the officials in a state, and more. These are all legitimate kinds of authority that we encounter in life. And from that, he's going to build and expand upon a Christian social theory. And that's going to provide the background for his Dewey's theory of the state.